In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Coming up on Chopper's Politics.
I think if Henley comes down to me,
you're bigger than Boris, him. You can just say,
yeah.
Sod off, Boris.
Well, yeah, we'll run down the towpath. First one who gets back to the town hall can have the seat. I'll take him on every day, any distance.
Hello and welcome to the Red Lion Pub in Westminster. I'm Christopher Hope, Chopper to my pals, Associate Editor for Politics at the Daily Telegraph. And this is Chopper's Politics Podcast. The battle lines over next year's general election are slowly taking shape over Brexit, housing, and immigration. But increasingly, the election looks like it's Labour's to lose. With me on this week's podcast, we'll be hearing from Culture Secretary Lucy Fraser on why she thinks all is not lost for the Tories, and from Rob Burley, one of the most experienced political producers in broadcasting, on why political TV interviews are often so unilluminating. Present company accepted, of course. But first, this week, former Scottish Secretary Alistair Jack became the 35th Conservative MP to say they will not fight the next general election. But not all Tories are so gloomy about the party's prospects at Westminster. Former Olympic rower James Cracknell has thrown his hat into the ring to become an MP, possibly in Henley-upon-Thames. Very appropriate for a rower. He joins me now in the Red Lion Pub. James Cracknell, Olympic hero, rowing legend, why on earth do you want to be a Conservative MP?
Well, I think in terms of being in politics at all, I was very lucky to be supported by the National Lottery, and you go to ceremonies and thanking the lottery, and you're there alongside other people, other recipients who all are doing selfless things. And I stood there as an anomaly, being the selfish, that you are doing it. Yes, the country really gets pleasure out of people winning the Olympics, but you're doing it for yourself and your teammates. And a lot is made of legacy. And actually, yes, it's brilliant people take up sport and be physically active, but the best way of having any form of legacy is to be involved in driving policy. A friend's dad once said to me, he goes, you go very fast in the boat backwards. I suppose that's useful. And that, when you're celebrated for going very fast in the boat backwards, it makes you think actually you should have more contribution.
Yeah.
What's the appeal right now? If the Tories win the election, it's their fifth successive election victory. It looks unlikely looking at the polling. So you'll be entering maybe a period of opposition, and you can't do anything in opposition. Why now? Isn't your timing a bit wrong?
Well, in terms of my personal motivation has been about public health and preventative healthcare. And my mum worked in NHS. And actually, for the benefit of the whole of society, I believe the NHS needs to shift focus to actually stop people getting ill. And that involves spending to save. And it's going to be a generational change, not within
So it's not about being in government, it's about being an MP to use a platform to make that change.
And that was my initial driver to get involved.
Well, what would you bring to your party if you become an MP and enter Parliament?
I think that actually the things that I've learned through my life in sport and things I've done afterwards about discipline, commitment, working in a team, dealing with pressure, setting a high agenda and working towards it, I think those are things that have been lost. Mm. And actually that's the thing that I'm not going to sit here and say I'm a policy expert on everything. What I absolutely am not afraid to challenge, not afraid to be challenged, and I will hold people to account and discipline and commitment and seeing it through. And the one thing that I've always done, taking sport, that our aim was to win a gold medal, that's binary. So second, we'd failed. Mm. Third, we'd failed. Fourth, and that second, third, fourth, fifth, it made no difference whether it was any of those. All of them had failed to achieve our objective. And that, I think, is something that would be a benefit to a constituency and the party in the country.
How do you think the public might see you?
I think the one difficulty, which is not just from a sporting perspective, I think it's one of the things that in Bristol we're not so good at, is we're very quick to pigeonhole people. And so they'll be like, a sportsman, you're in a box, and therefore you can't jump out of that box into politics. The same as an actor wants to be a politician, they'll find it hard, or an actor wants to be a singer.
I mean, you think of Seb Coe, of course.
It's really interesting having a conversation with Seb Coe about it, from his time when he fought it for the first time, and the challenges involved in winning over an association, the difficulty in trying to retain the seat when Tony Blair came to power, was not the greatest election for the Conservatives, and just the different perceptions. And for him, it was, again, he was the guy who had run, then he stepped away, and having that profile meant that he was always, you know, it suddenly went between, he was the runner, then he was William Hayes' judo partner. It's belittled, and then he flicks around to putting on the Olympics that everyone said was going to be a failure. Then president of the IAAF. And so he gave me the honest objective of the highs are high and the lows are really difficult. Mm-hmm. And one of the most interesting things he told me was that he was going around associations and he was, you know, in the lead up to getting selected and then building the association base to get elected for the first time. And he thought he'd done a really good speech, and he was in the car with his political agent afterwards, who kind of sort of read the room for him. And he was like, you know, well, they wish you'd worn a tie. And it's just that you are going to, you cannot control in.
Well, you're not wearing one now. I don't mind. Who have you met in the party? You've met.
You know, what's been really pleasurable about this process is, and it's not what I expected, having been in sport or business, is I really like the way Johnny Mercer comes across on Twitter. And I dropped him an email saying, would it be possible to come and meet you and just talk about, you know, how to get selected? It was yes. And then Steve Barclay, dropped him an email, possible to talk? Yes. And it's really interesting that in the right way, you think people, you know, the perception from the outside, maybe politicians are all in it for themselves. They've been incredibly giving.
Well, they want new voices. They want new faces in the Tory party, as far as I can make out, because everyone's very familiar with the cast as it is at the moment. So why Henley on Thames, apart from the 14,000 Tory majority at the last election?
I think, look, let's be honest, represent anywhere is a huge honour. And there's far, far more candidates than there are seats. And also, you know, you've got a number of the current sitting MPs maybe worried that they're not going to be in their seats. So it's a hugely competitive place. But, you know, Henley, for me, you know, started rather when I was 18. I lived in Henley when I got married. My first child was born there. And, you know, my personal and professional highs have been based around the town. And I've got so many friends there, both in the businesses in Henley, but also on the sporting side. But the reality is, Henley may be the name of the constituency, but if I was in Tame or Watlington or Chinner, I would be going, he'll be in it for Henley. He's not in it for us. You know, so that's, if I'm going to have any chance there, I've got to go around and spend the time and meet people and find out what they really want from their MP.
And do you live there? Do you, or you live in there?
No, I live in West London at the moment, but would I live there? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And you feel a tap on the shoulder and it's a blonde former Prime Minister saying, clear off Cracknell, I want my seat back. What would you say?
I would say, you're going to have bigger people to worry about than me. I think if Henley comes down to
me, you're bigger than Boris, him. You're saying, sod off, Boris.
We'll run down the towpath. First one who gets back to the town hall can have the seat. I'll take him on every day, any distance.
Just ask you about your policy. Are you a low tax Tory? Do you want to cut taxes? Are they too high?
I think the moment, I would say the taxation and the cost of living crisis are closely aligned. I think what taxation, from my perspective, seems to, you know, it acts as a break and
on the economy,
on the economy and people's productivity, and it leads to inertia. But the armed force, the NHS, the police, the fire service, and then it's a sliding scale to what you think taxation should contribute to, and then you need to work out how you're going to generate that income.
But are they too high at the moment?
I think corporation tax, I would look at that as a way of solving it. I think in terms of getting people flowing, would VAT benefit from being trimmed a bit?
Outside the EU, we can do that.
I think if you want Britain to appear to be a country to invest in, then putting corporation tax up now with the combination of the cost of living crisis is not good.
and income tax?
There, I would say that there's a, you read enough about 40% being the one where the demotivating factor comes in. I interviewed Tony Jacklin.
The golfer.
When you saw the Telegraph. And when he won the US Open, he was saying that
69, was it?
Yeah. Like, every £8 of every 10 went to the tax man, and then he moved abroad.
Yeah.
And that so...
We're nowhere near that.
Yeah, we're nowhere near that. But that's at some point, everyone has their threshold.
Yeah, yeah. Have you met Rishi Sunak?
No.
And what's he doing right and wrong? You think he's doing okay?
Yeah, no, I think he is doing. What he inherited and who took over, the state he did, he absolutely.
He's half Labour's poll lead, but Labour are still 17 points ahead, aren't they? They're still a long way away.
They're a long way away, but the reality is, when I was doing sport, it's much harder to be a champion than an underdog. And right now we're the underdog, and you've got to call them in, hold them in, and... Mm. Everyone wants to watch the Grand National, and you think with one furlong to go, this horse is miles out of the lead, and they start bottling it. And you never know. Look, hey,
and
at this point,
can you win the election? You
know, at this point, over the last year, I'd have thought Kirsten would be further ahead.
Yes.
That means, okay, hang on. So either he's playing a very good game and not wanting to be too much of a front runner, or actually, we're doing something right.
Well, he's a lucky leader, so he's lost Boris Johnson, Nicola Sturgeon of Scotland, and the left has disappeared. Corbyn's been kicked out, Dan Abbott. I mean, it's all the oppo has fallen away, hasn't it?
Yes, but then if your lead's getting chewed back and you've had the perfect storm of all the major characters going, people will be going, hang on, have you got it?
And the Tories can win the election next year?
Absolutely. I think, look, it's...
Will they?
Firstly, you get to do the things right that... The five things that Rishi Sunak laid out, get them right, and then you're batting on having achieved something. I think there's real reputational wins to be done with strikes and boats in the channel. Those are reputational wins that will do a huge amount.
And what is it, the party to you? Are you a Thatcherite Tory?
I was born in 72, so I grew up, my first memory of her was...
In 79.
It was being Prime Minister, and she was still Prime Minister when I went to university.
Yeah.
Admittedly, she only lasted 3 weeks into my first term of university before she got replaced. In terms of what makes me a conservative, I would say is that it's a party that allows and supports people to do what they want and gives them the freedom to do it and is there if it doesn't work. And whereas Labour especially, they're more tell you what to do and just lay it out that way.
And that's what drives you towards the Tories, the idea that you left alone.
I've set my target and I will do everything I can to achieve it. They take the brakes off, rather than throwing sort of sand in the gears, which is done with too much legislation and too much, not using the free market.
Is your mum still working in NHS or is she?
No, she's retired. Although I broke my wrist a few weeks ago and she was full of advice for that. She used to be physio.
Where do you stand on the strikes, the nurses striking and the NHS workers striking?
I definitely agree with the right to strike. I think
but the pay rise, the money they want?
I think the most important is to look at why there is the lack of doctors, why people are leaving the profession, the lack of nurses. I think with the problem, you've got to look at the cause of
overwork, long hours,
and difficult. So I think that's
working
part
conditions,
of it,
money.
It being solved is actually... we need to make positive action on...
But a pay rise, James, to pin you down?
No, I think, yes. I think, look, everyone's been having this cost of living. I would, yes, a pay rise, but then at what point does it then inflict on everyone else? And it's...
In terms of inflation and the rest?
I don't know enough about whether it's the right... No. What figure it is, but do they deserve more? Yes, but there'd be infinite number of professions that say the same. And you've got to be careful. Now, I don't think that... take out the rail strikes, that... doing it to really convince people. How many people that they get support from benefit if you're cancelling trains on the day of the FA Cup final when two teams are coming down from Manchester. There's things that it's going to get pushed back, but everyone deserves a fair wage.
Yeah, yeah. You had a very bad injury, didn't you, when you were hit by a lorry in Arizona? Mm-hmm. That's a huge thing you've dealt with there. How are you doing now?
No, really good now. Really good now. And actually, it's interesting, you're just talking about the NHS, it happened when I was in America and I got helicoptered to hospital in America, had lots of treatment there. And then there was a big argument about insurance and everything. The insurance company, the guy who hit me, his insurance company covered the stay in America and it was agreed that I'll cover the stay in the UK. 6 weeks in America, a month here. And the bill that we had to pay was £79 for Wi-Fi. And theirs was 800,000. Okay, theirs was a helicopter as well, but it was over £800,000. And that's the difference.
And that's where the NHS, James.
And that's where it goes back to the fair pay. And so, the nurses are amazing. And do you know what? It's really interesting. I broke my wrist about 5 weeks ago and I went into A&E and I was in a real pain. And they were amazing there. And I went back, I had to have an operation 3 days later, but I went back with some, just for Easter, with some Easter eggs and some biscuits just to leave at A&E and say thank you. And I went to reception. I go, can I go to the A&E and leave these? And they're like, why do you want to do that? Mm. So I just want to say thank you. And actually it was such an unusual thing for someone to come that it was, yes, we're really happy to go outside and clap, but actually just meet someone face to face and then say thank you. It was treated with suspicion rather than what should be a normality.
And comes more thank yous.
Thank yous. And that does, that comes from the way we treat them when we meet them, the way we support them in their pay claims.
I'm afraid the Telegraph in 2019 did say that you were ticking all the boxes of a spectacular midlife crisis. I'm sorry about this. You got a tattoo, apparently, and you rode a motorbike.
Well, I've ridden a motorbike since I was 19. I've had tattoos since I was 19. So that's,
this isn't one, is the point. Being a Tory MP isn't a midlife crisis, James.
Well, no. I mean, in terms of... I don't know how long midlife crisis lasts. But
be honest,
in
the past...
I came on, first one on the candidates in 2013. So yeah, it's been decade-long midlife crisis. So it's people have... midlife is a long period of time, I think. Yeah. And... unlike most careers, if you are, say, a sportsman, is that my career highlight was when I was 28, 32, won the Olympics then. Yeah. And then do I go on and do another one? And then I could have carried on. I felt if I carried on and I was in my mid-30s, I would only ever be a rower. And I felt it was something I did rather than who I am. And then the question you get asked most is, what are you doing now? And actually... nothing feels, because that's been my focus for 15 years, nothing seems as worthwhile in your head. Whereas representing a constituency, a party, and trying to help preventative healthcare is worth it.
If you lose, then what? If you don't become an MP, then what?
If I was racing, if I trained well, prepared well, and raced flat out, and we lost, I'd hold my hands up and say, not good enough. So if I get to the end of the situation and I have been the best version of myself, I have met everyone in the constituency and I have been given the best account and prepared and had the best team around me and lose, then...
We thought about a run for London Mayor. There were Tories selecting a candidate this summer.
I got the email through for you're well on the known. Approved list.
You're well known. Charismatic.
Well, that's the
charismatic.
I'm not sure.
Chap. You can grow up and down the Thames or now hail and vote for me. Come on.
You should have been part of my team when I got divorced. Charismatic and handsome. Where was that?
You're going to go for it?
The one thing that I have been really good at is...
Is it?
No, it kind of is. If I'm doing something, it's focusing on a one target. And if there's a lot of seats going to be selected between now and the party conference... in October. So I would say splitting my focus on two things would not benefit either. Also...
So you thought about it?
I thought about, if there's a benefit to getting people knowing you're into politics, if I did put my name into the mayor, I would get, okay, he's interested in politics, but I think it would lose focus. And I think that's really insulting to seats where I'll be applying to, that actually, do you want us or do you want to be Mayor of London?
So that's a no, isn't it?
It's a no, yeah.
Well, James Cracknell, prospective MP, maybe next year. Thank you for joining us this week on Choppers Politics Podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
James Cracknell there. Right, do stay with us, listeners. Coming up, we'll hear from one of broadcasting's most experienced political producers on how to get the most from an interview with a politician. And they'll reveal also which feared TV interviewer once read a speech for the Prime Minister of the day, one Margaret Thatcher, right after this.
Nigel Farage.
This is the most commonest thing done by any government in my lifetime in this country.
Lionel Shriver.
Which is worse, Biden's not being in control and Biden being in control?
Charles Moore.
I think if people in general feel that their traditions, culture, history, values, etc. are under assault, they are basically right.
My name is Stephen Edgington, and if you're enjoying this podcast, you might like Off Script, a new series from The Telegraph. Provocative conversations with provocative individuals. Each episode, I sit down with a world-leading commentator to unpick the ongoing culture wars. Unfiltered, unscripted, and full of free speech. Be sure to listen to Off Script in the same place you're listening to this, and make sure to follow so you don't miss an episode.
Now, it's been a busy few weeks for the UK's cultural sector, with the Coronation and Eurovision Song Contest on successive weekends. Culture Secretary Lucy Fraser has been at the heart of the drama, and she thinks the UK's leadership and soft power is something to shout about. So, Lucy Fraser, welcome to Chopper's Politics Podcast. Are you used to Red Lion Pub? Are you a denizen here?
I've been here a couple of times, I must say, yes.
Do you plot
I'm not,
here?
I'm
plot?
Not a regular. I'm not a plotter. I'm
no.
not a plotter, no, no.
You
get
know,
on with the job.
Get on with the job. And you're making a speech today, haven't you, about the creative industries and the importance
yes.
of it and jobs.
Yes. Jobs, creativity, world-class
yeah.
sector.
Yeah.
I'm so lucky to represent this sector. It's just a fabulous
sector. Well,
it's
the best job in government, isn't it?
That's what they told me, and they're absolutely right, yes.
You spent the last few weeks, you've been at the coronation, at the
yeah.
Eurovision, I'm sure you were there, at Windsor for the concert. I mean, it's quite a time.
I've had an amazing week. I mean, as you say, the coronation, mm-hmm. which, you know, my department were responsible for doing the coordination.
Yeah.
So amazing to do that. And then, of course, Eurovision the following week, but it's just so fabulous.
The you two know, sides to, of Britain, right? Heritage and then Eurovision and looking at
yeah, heritage tradition in terms of the coronation, mm. you know, modernity, first class.
Yeah.
BBC content, but both bringing, actually, interestingly, both international events in yeah. different ways and putting Britain on the world stage. So, yeah. you know, the coronation, we had 200 foreign dignitaries here, had 6,000 people accredited in terms of press accreditation. So that was Britain on the world stage showing tradition. Mm-hmm. And then a week later, obviously, you know, on behalf of Ukraine, mm-hmm. so very poignant. So it's not just about the competition and the creativity and the huge music talent that we have, but also about how we are standing with Ukraine on the international stage, also seen by 160 million people.
We do all quite well, don't we? Why do you think people have a down on this country who are here? Is it a left-wing thing, suspicious of heritage and pomp and circumstance?
I think we undersell ourselves as a country. You know, it's that great British understatement, you know, where we're always looking at ourselves and, you know, not thinking we're quite good enough, not talking ourselves up. Whereas actually, I think we're perceived to be world class. You know, people are often looking to us and saying, well, how should you do this? You know, how can we be like you? In the industries I represent, people want to be at the forefront of the creative industries in other countries. South Korea is trying to copy what we do in terms of music. So I think sometimes we undersell ourselves. You know, there's a little bit of navel gazing, unfortunately. And I think we should just promote and be proud to be British.
Yeah. Is it linked to taxation, do you think? I mean, it needs to be more tax breaks for the creative industries.
There are significant tax breaks.
Is that enough?
So one of the reasons why the creative industries are so successful and world leading is because of the tax breaks. You know, George Osborne, Conservative government, brought in quite a lot of tax breaks for the creative industries. And I was really proud and pleased that one of the first things that happened when I became the Secretary of State was we got some further tax breaks. We got tax reliefs that were continuing in a whole range of my sectors, because the Chancellor recognised that that was the right thing to do to ensure that we maintained our position on the world stage. Because we mustn't be complacent. There's huge international competition and we need to keep ahead at every stage.
We mentioned our heritage there, didn't we, Lucy Fraser? Where do you stand on slavery reparations, and is it something which the government could do more on?
Overall, we should be proud of our history. Obviously, in that I don't mean slavery. I just mean, you know, we should be a proud nation, and we should understand our history and where we have come from. We should explain our history so that we understand for the future. I think we can't whitewash what has happened in the past. I think we only learn if we acknowledge and explain and then go forward. Obviously, reparations is, you know, slightly distinct from that. But I think overall, I don't agree with whitewashing history.
Issues of those all areas like the Elgin Marbles, the British Museum. I mean, should they go back? That's currently being discussed by the chairman of the museum there, George Osborne.
It is, and I've met George on a number of occasions. As I mentioned, my starting point is that we have a history that we should explain. And the Elgin Marbles are here in the British Museum for the world to see. You know, one in five people who comes to the UK visits the British Museum. The particular decision about, you know, whether the Elgin Marbles should go back is a matter for the trustees of the British Museum.
And they legally can't,
but the law
can they?
Is they legally can't, and we have absolutely no intention of changing the law. But how the British Museum, you know, works within that is a question for the trustees.
Yeah. And more widely then, you want us to be more celebratory of our culture here, do you think? There's a natural crouch in this country you want to get rid of.
Definitely. You know, I think we should be so proud to be British, and we should be celebrating that, whether that's our history, whether it's, you know, our present. And I think we should be shouting about it on the world stage.
And it's not happening at the moment because there's a kind of embarrassment, is there, about it?
I think it's just British reservedness. I do think we do it, but I think we could do it even more.
This is looking at the BBC. There's lots of talk about why the government appoints a chairman of the BBC. Do you think that's right, the way it's structured at the moment?
I think what we need to do in this process is make sure we get the right person for the job. There is a process, actually, I think little understood. The BBC charter sets out the process, so we, the government, will be following the process that's set out in the charter.
Should Labour have a say? Because there might be an election. You wrinkle your eyebrows there.
I'm not sure why Labour should have a say. Well, this is an appointment of the BBC, which is a fair and open competition.
Yes.
We will be embarking upon, and we will choose the right person for the job. And there is a process which is set out in the charter. It's also, you know, a lot of public appointments are made through various governments, Labour and Conservative, which set out the procedure, and that's the procedure we'll be following.
Historically, it's been someone who's
and faithful. You just suggest that. I think you were going on to say, and you know, Labour government, you know.
Well, I was going to say, because the polls are suggesting Labour might win next election, you could make it a cross-party appointment. That's what I was going to say.
Yes,
I know you don't like that because you're a Tory politician.
You know, who says Labour's? I mean, you know, I think you know, there's a long way to go to the next election.
Yes. Should Tories be suspicious of the BBC or not? Or is it just overblown?
So the BBC has a fundamental role in respecting impartiality. It's a public service broadcaster, and it should be impartial in its content. And I think the Director of the General of the BBC understands that. We are doing a midterm review at the moment on impartiality. It's paid for by the licence fee payer, and it's really important that it produces good British content the British people want to see, and it should absolutely be impartial.
Yeah. One issue that kind of frustrates Telegraph readers and listeners to the podcast is the way that charities pursue maybe political objectives, which are maybe at odds with where some of their donors are, the supporters are. Where do you sit with that?
So charities do huge amounts of work, probably asking me because charities fall within my portfolio.
Exactly.
And I think we should celebrate the massive amount they do. And on a local level, they are absolutely fundamental. Through COVID, they were absolutely fundamental. They do amazing work. And as you say, your readers, you know, millions of people across the country are volunteering for fantastic organisations that are the bedrock of our society. But when you're a charity, you cannot support a political party. And I think that is right. And I don't think individuals want their charity to whom they're giving money to be taking a political positions in party terms. They may, of course, campaign for the cause that they represent, but they shouldn't be getting involved in politics in the purest sense of the word.
And that's quite a hard line to follow, isn't it? Because I guess they're going into an election period too. You have notably charities criticising the government's migrant policy, for example, which may overset the mark in some eyes.
Yeah, so I think the head of the Charity Commission is quite rightly...
Orlando Fraser.
Yeah, it's quite rightly said that there's this legal line that they need to draw, and they should. They, of course, they can share views on their campaign issues, but they cannot support or go against, get into the political arena of a particular political party.
Because giving charity isn't really a political thing. You do it because you believe in a cause, not you don't want to have that...
Yes,
by
absolutely. Most people think they're helping people. That's what people want to do when they donate to a charity, whether that's a domestic charity or an international charity. They think they are supporting people or creating a better world.
Yeah. How have you found this week in Conservative politics? Have you been watching this National Conservative Conference?
No, I think it's great that we have debate in the country. I'm, as you know, also within my department, falls the media. And I think I'm proud to be in a democracy where we can debate issues. So good to have a debate. But as a party, what we're doing is getting on and delivering. I think what people want to see us do is deliver and change their lives. And that is what the government and me are focused on.
And what drives your politics? Are you a Thatcherite? Is it family values? What drives
you? I'm driven by a feeling that we should be empowering people to stand on their own two feet. I believe that everybody is fundamentally capable of, and everybody holds a huge amount of potential, and it's different potential. Everybody does something different. And I believe that we as a government should be supporting them to fulfill their potential, to live the life that they want to live. So it's about life. For me, it's about life opportunities. Life chances and opportunities. And for me, that's what conservatism is all about.
So you want the government to move away from people's lives and let them get on with it?
I want them to empower them. So government has a role in supporting people. I was the Minister for Youth Justice, and I saw how sometimes people fall down the cracks and people don't make the right decisions. And we have a role as a government to help them get back onto the right track. But once we have done that, I think we should let them get on with their lives and have the freedom to operate how they wish, and we should interfere as little as possible in their lives going forward.
What made you want to become an MP when you were a successful QC, weren't you, in Chambers?
Because I always wanted to make a difference. So when I left university, you know, when you're really young, we were just saying before how old we both are, and when you're really young, you think you're going to save the world. And I had that sort of naive ambition that I was going to save the world. Yes. And I went to work for a number of organizations when after university, I took a year off to work for a number of organizations that I thought were key instigators of change. So I spent a little bit of time at the UN. I worked for the European Commission. I'd actually worked at the Ministry of Justice in another country. And I was really disappointed, because I realized that when you're 21 in your list, like this tiny cog in this huge wheel, you can't make any change. So my grandma was a barrister. I'd always wanted to be a barrister since I was about 7. So I went to the bar.
To help people, I suppose, or present the best cases for people.
Well, I was a commercial lawyer and I worked in insolvency.
Forgive me.
But to get people's voices heard in the best possible way. But I never really lost that desire to make a difference. And I thought, I looked into different ways of doing it. So I actually applied, for example, to be a commissioner on the Social Mobility Commission.
Did you?
I didn't get it.
Did you?
I had absolutely no skills
for that
job
appointed.
At all.
Now you're appointed. Yeah.
How life works out. And then one day it just occurred to me that actually the best way and biggest way that you can make a difference is to be an MP. And there are lots of disadvantages to being an MP, but I thought that's the biggest way you can make a difference.
How do you cope with the disadvantages of it, the imposition on your family life? You know, how do you do it?
You just get on with it. You just get on with it. And, you know, it's such a privilege to be an MP. I do feel that you can help on every level, an individual level, a regional level, a national level, and the counterbalance to all the aggro that, you know, we get, the counterbalance of the ability to change people's lives, to get things done, to make a difference. You know, we are just so lucky and privileged to be able to do that.
And this is finally the election next year.
Yep.
You're going to win?
Of course. I don't
do that. How are you so sure when you're 17 points behind this?
Yeah, so that was a little bit flippant, wasn't it? look, I'm an optimist. And I think that obviously as a Conservative and as an MP, I think that we have the right approach to government. So I want us to win. I think that what we need to do is to show people that we can deliver. And I think once we have done that, and I think we're on track to do that, I think then we earn the right for people to listen to what we've got to say. And I think that, I mean, I saw a shift. I was obviously campaigning in the local elections. We actually held our council. It remained Conservative against Lib Dems. And I saw a change in the way people were approaching the Conservatives. You know, at the beginning, not so, you know, angry and disappointed. But I think that we're earning the right for people to listen to us. So. I'm optimistic, but absolutely not complacent about the outcome.
Well, Lucy Fraser, Culture Secretary, thank you for joining us this week for Chopper's Politics Podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lucy Fraser there. Now, why is that lying bastard lying to me was famously the phrase BBC Newsnight presenter Jeremy Paxman used to describe his approach to TV interviewing. And it's also the title of a new book by top TV political producer Rob Burley. Rob has worked with the big political interview beasts of the age, Jeremy Paxman, of course, Andrew Neil and Emily Maitlis, to name but a few. So I asked Rob to join me in the Red Lion pub to share some tips. Rob Burley, welcome to Chopper's Politics Podcast here in the Red Lion Pub. I'm sure you've been here a few times.
I have actually, not for a few years. I used to come here when I was a researcher. I used to work for a Labour MP called Paul Flynn, the late Paul Flynn, a lovely man.
He was a great man. He was the thorn in Blair's side, wasn't he?
So in those days I used to come. But actually, I make a bit of a point in the book. Once I was doing stuff at the BBC and ITV before that, I didn't really do much socialising with special advisors or politicians, really. I sort of somehow didn't really sit well with me.
No, you wanted to be apart.
Yeah.
Your book's called Why Is This Lying Bastard Lying to Me? Are you happy with that title? It's quite a cynical title about politics, isn't it?
I am happy with it because it's a great title, Chris. Come on, that's
the truth. It's a famous quote from Jeremy Paxton to the media show or something when he was starting out on Newsnight.
Yeah, the point about it is it's a great title because it just is a good title. But also, I think that it means something, which is that it invites you to kind of engage in that question about how politicians and the media interact with each other. And it was made by, or you know, it was actually an old quote recycled by Jeremy Paxton, you know, one of the premier political interviewers of all time, who I worked with quite closely. So it has got a rude word in it, and it might seem a bit cynical, but it's not me saying they're all lying bastards.
No. I had Lucy Fraser, the culture secretary, on this podcast, and she was talking about how she wants to help people stand on their own two feet who can't. And so from their point of view, they come at it from a kind of noble position, don't they?
Politicians.
They don't think they're lying bastards, do they?
No. And I think I actually don't think that most of them are doing this for bad reasons at all. Not for a moment. I think actually the opposite is true.
But they can't be truthful all the time, is your point.
Yeah, they choose to speak in a particular way. They choose to, obviously, look, this is a two-way street. What I would like to see is some kind of new relationship where we can actually have meaningful conversations rather than just defensive ones. But it does require them to move as well as the media. There have been intermittent moments where the media, you know, I remember Ian Katz, who was when I was at Newsnight, shortly after I left, he tried to reset the relationship. But it was a bit like unilateral disarmament, really. Newsnight gave up their weapons. The government and the politicians shot them anyway.
Yes.
You know, because
is it our fault, though? The term gotcha question is now used on Twitter, isn't it, to attack journalism? Oh, that's a gotcha question. I'm almost to disregard the question. But a gotcha question is trying to get some revelatory moment from the politician, isn't it?
Yeah, it's trying to find something out. I mean, one of the interviews I was most sort of happy to be involved with, and it was quite famous, was Boris Johnson in the 2019 leadership election, if you may remember, when he was asked, talking about the GATT agreement, talking about paragraph 5B, because he knew about paragraph 5B. Our question in our meetings before that was, does he know anything about 5C? And we suspected he probably didn't. Now, that isn't a gotcha, because it's not just there only to actually create embarrassment. It's there to reveal something about a sort of superficial understanding that we suspected he had. And he had to admit on air that he didn't know what was in 5C. So is that a gotcha? I wouldn't say so.
Now, in your time, you've worked with Andrew Marr, Andrew Neil, Jeremy Paxman, Ellen Maitlis, and goes back. And your book goes back further than that into, you know, Brian Walden, the great political interviewer of the 80s, Sir Robin Day, about how they developed the idea and the question to ask. You talk about the famous John Knott interview when he walked out. And the way it was phrased, you know, that was after the Falklands War. I mean, tell the story.
So I'm a kid. In the 70s and 80s, there was not much on telly. Right,
yes. You know, four channels.
Yeah, so we got four channels in 1982. I'd watch anything. I was just watching it, so I'd find myself watching impenetrable editions of Weekend World at the age of sort of 10
on Sunday mornings.
But I remember this moment vividly because it was that moment when the artifice of government and power fell away, because John Knott, who was then the defense secretary, who was about to leave the Commons, so I say in the book he wasn't so much demob happy as demob grumpy as he walks into that room. He sits down with the Grand Inquisitor Sir Robin Day to talk about cuts to the Navy, which was quite an emotive thing to do in months after the triumph in the South Atlantic. And in that interview, Robin Day, in his wonderful style, describes Knott as a here today, and if I may say so, gone tomorrow politician. So what I try and recreate in the book is just the way that he does that, the way that it feels for Knott, and then Knott sort of pushes himself out of his chair, has a look around, because you need to know where the exit is if you're going to storm off. sees where he, and chucks that microphone back at Sir Robin Day and leaves. And Knott, I think, has a bit of a difficult relationship with this reality, which is that whatever he did, he had a very impressive career as a defense secretary in a war. The thing that people will remember is that he walked out into Robin Day.
And that kind of question, the if I may say so point, which you leap on in the book as the moment of maximum impact, is that scripted or is that just him, do you think?
Obviously, I wasn't in his ear, but I would imagine with Day, that was him. Mm. He was an acerbic character. He was a very clever man. Mm. And he understood theatre. This is the thing. Yeah. Theatre is really important in political interviews.
And that is theatre walking out. But it doesn't tell us much. So had Knott stayed there and answered the question, whatever it was, I can't remember the question now, of course.
Well, the question was about, he was very unhappy that Sir Robin was in a way trying to create a division between him and people from the services, who were obviously briefing the papers that they were unhappy about the cuts that were being planned. And I think, what does it tell us? I suppose what it told me as a young person was that politicians are people. They'll get pissed off, pardon my French, they'll get annoyed. They will leave sometimes, they'll walk out, and things can happen that are not the sort of controlled way that we always have. Mm. And I think that's quite a moment.
Do you want moments in interviews, or yeah. do you want information in interviews?
You want both. I mean, I don't think the moments are of any value. And like the Boris Johnson moment I described to you about 5B and 5C only has value because it's meaningful. Okay,
so it shows he's not cross detail.
Yeah, well, that was the point. And that was one of the great concerns about him. Was that borne out? Perhaps it was, you know. So I think what you don't want to do is just seek. Because what we see now, you see, is we have, what, 5 to 7 minute interviews on the telly? The interviewers are too often seeking moments just without any kind of depth to it or time given to
it. That involves interruption, doesn't it?
Yes, too much interruption.
Does that annoy you now? Now you're out left the BBC, can you say that?
Of course. No, I think it's not just the BBC. I think interruption can be a problem. But I think actually for viewers and listeners, they probably dislike not answering the question more than they dislike interruption. I mean, they dislike both of those things. But it's not answering the question that I think is the most problematic thing of those things.
Mm. You mentioned in the book, of course, the famous interview with Michael Howard and Jeremy Paxman.
Yes.
When it was about Derek Lewis from memory and this whether Derek Lewis knew something or didn't know something. And he kept asking the same question over and over again. And Paxman said since then, hasn't he, that he couldn't think of what else to ask him. So he kept asking the same question.
Yeah, but I think Jeremy's, he sort of wrapped that up in that way. He tried to sort of play it down a bit. He said that sometimes. He also said, the reason I carried on was because the next item wasn't ready yet, which is just, if you watch it, it just doesn't make any sense because the interview goes on for some time after that. The truth, as he put it to me, was that I was just sick of the bullshit. That's what he said to me. So it felt to me in a way that he was sick of being asked the question about it. And then when he told me wearily, he said, I was just sick of the bullshit. Mm. He was sick of this unwritten rule that after 3 times or so, which is Andrew Neil's rule, when they don't answer
you
the question,
on.
You move on. And I think that was, again, a moment where it revealed the process.
A lot about Howard, didn't it? I mean, it really damaged Howard badly.
Yeah, and I think Jeremy asserts that did for him. And I think that's what Howard probably thought. So he wasn't happy about it. But, you know, the thing is, that rule, that unwritten rule, isn't understood by the public. Mm. So Jeremy decides to break the rule. Rule breaking is fun to watch.
And Paxman, famous, didn't have many friends who are politicians. He says so in your book. But Brian Walden, a famous inquisitor from the 80s, really sort of set the benchmark for a lot of these interviews. But actually, he was quite close to Margaret Thatcher, you found out.
My God, it's such an extraordinary story. I mean, when I wrote the book, one of the reasons the contrast in my head when I started this book was Boris Johnson hiding in a fridge, hiding from GMB back in 2019.
And Piers Morgan's into questions.
Yes, and Susanna Reid, who's actually a better interviewer, by the way. And set against Margaret Thatcher, 1989. She just lost her chancellor, Nigel Lawson, a colossal figure in her government. She's in her biggest political crisis to date, and she goes onto the television for 46 minutes. To be interviewed by Brian Walden. Now, just a quick history of this, because it is fascinating. Brian Walden was a Labour MP. He was a grammar school boy who went to Oxford, so very similar to Mrs. Thatcher in that respect. He wasn't really a socialist. He says he kind of got it in his mother's milk. He never really believed it. He was more of a meritocrat. And by the time the 70s, early 70s came around, and Mrs. Thatcher in the mid-70s became leader of the Tory party, Walden was kind of Thatcher curious, you know, wondering maybe this was where he was ideologically going to find a home. But before anything could happen with that, like crossing the floor or anything, he was suddenly whisked out of this world of politics in terms of parliament and became a presenter on Weekend World on ITV. His first ever guest was Mrs. Thatcher in September 77. They developed this on-screen relationship and conversational style that was, I've watched them back, they are revealing. They show her in real time thinking about how far she can go about union power, which she was very sympathetic about. There was too much union power. She just sketches forward onto Thatcherism. And then when she becomes prime minister, this continues. Victorian values was said by him to her in an interview, and she ran with it. She told him that we only remember the Good Samaritan because he had money. So they had this relationship that was very close. So close, this is extraordinary. In 1983, the general election, okay, this is the second term. Mrs. Thatcher seeking a second term. Older listeners may remember a very famous rally that took place with the Young Conservatives in that campaign, which featured Kenny Everett, the comedian, the late comedian.
With his big hands.
Big hands, like an evangelical. He said, let's bomb Russia. let's kick Michael Foot's stick away. Yes. And all this stuff was an outrage about it. Faux outrage, really, because it was kind of funny. But Mrs. Thatcher, who that morning had been interviewed by Brian Walden on ITV, went to that rally and was pumped up. They were crying, Maggie, Maggie, Maggie. She was really into it. And she arrived very late at night to record her final election broadcast to the country to say, give me a second term, carry on, let's finish the job we started. And the script that she had did not fit her mood that night. Mm. What she wanted was a different script. And Ian Gow, who worked very closely with her, I think it was her private secretary.
Yes.
Yeah. He was looking around to find who's the best person to write this script. And extraordinarily, he decided to ask Brian Walden, which is a very interesting thing to have done, because this is a man who was an impartial TV presenter, interviewer, grand inquisitor. That's extraordinary. He even asked, even more extraordinary, he said yes.
Yes.
And he got out of his bed by these accounts, and he came to this place and he wrote this script. And a few days later, Mrs. Thatcher was re-elected. And on
that, wow.
extraordinary. And their relationship then continued on air while she was prime minister and he was the interviewer. Now, to finish the end of that story, extraordinarily, in 1989, the moment comes when Nigel Lawson has resigned and Mrs. Thatcher has this interview for 46 minutes with Brian Morden. There was a palpable sense in the media at that time, particularly on the left, and The Independent wrote a big piece about this on the day of this interview, that this man was going to not deliver the reckoning that they thought she deserved, given where she was, because he was a fellow traveller. So for him, there's a great deal of pressure to demonstrate that he was the journalist first and that he would do what needed to be done. And if you remember, I don't know if you can remember the interview, it is a pretty...
It's brutal, isn't it?
It's pretty brutal. He presses her. She's not very good at answering, or not answering the question about why Lawson had gone. She can't answer it properly. Yeah. And then he says that people think you're off your trolley. You don't really call the Prime Minister of the nation mad on television, which is kind of the implication of that. But this was the kind of thing people said after We Have Become a Grandmother. People thought she sort of slightly lost it, which is unfair, you know, I think in retrospect. So this played out in the way it did. And within weeks, there was the first leadership challenge against her from Sir Anthony Mayer.
So he created her and ended her slightly.
Well, yeah. And you know what? They didn't speak again. That was the last time they spoke to each other. That was the end of that very close relationship.
And do you think they went to Walden because they thought here's someone who can get the best out of her?
I think
then allowed himself to be brought into that, but perhaps he was putting down a down payment on future interviews, possibly.
Possibly. But I also think that, and this is really, really important, is that getting the best out of her is a good thing. We learned a lot about Mrs. Thatcher.
And that's what interviews should be about, isn't it?
It's one of the things. It depends what the situation is, right? And also, it takes two to tango. But Mrs. Thatcher and Brian Morden, they certainly tangoed. You know, they talked about things and we learned things. But when it came to a prosecutorial moment, which is a different kind of thing, he delivered that too. So he was redeemed by what happened subsequently.
That's an amazing story put to paid the notion that current political editors and reporters are more biased.
In a way it does, doesn't it? It tells you that simpatico relationship between politicians and the media is as old as the hills, you know, because these are people who are, in a way, they're similar. They're interested in ideas. They're interested in politics. They want to engage with each other. And often, as in the case here, we're seeing people, well, we see it now all the time with MPs having their own shows, which is another conversation. But Brian was an ex-MP. He was from that political world. I mean, Sir Robin Day tried to become an MP. He was imbued in that with that. Paxman didn't. Paxman was kind of didn't really want to be involved in that. But there was always that kind of danger. And I think he has to be alive to that danger for sure.
What's your tips for getting the best out of a good interviewer? Are you not to do this one like I've done it? But
I think it depends really what you're trying to get out of it. If getting the best out of a politician can mean allowing them to kind of speak and say what they think, or it can mean kind of revealing that they don't know what they're talking about. So let me say a few things. First of all, give them time. I think one of the problems we've got in our political culture here, and it wasn't there when Brian Morden and Margaret Thatcher were talking, is we just don't give it time. We try and hurry through it in 5 or 6 minutes, and it's just, you're not going to get results. Listen to what they say, because just like politicians can become locked into a kind of set of lines, sometimes interviewers can do the same thing. They're so bound up in their own sort of questions and clever thoughts that they're not interested in what they
say. It's not about them, is it? It's about the listener and what the person's saying.
It's about the public. And Robin Day and Jerry Paxman always felt that very keenly. Make a plan, okay? What you don't do is walk in without a plan with just a sort of idea in your head and you just go and wing it. That's never the best way in any walk of life. You've got to prepare to succeed. Have a theme, okay? Because there's 5 stories in the newspapers this morning. I'm just going to run through them all and try and get answers and news lines from the politicians. I used to have an approach which was, what is the truth? So when you come up to an interview, you're trying to understand in a nuanced way, not in a kind of silly, simplistic way. What is the situation they're in? What are they looking at? What are they weighing up, for example? And do the big stuff with them. Don't get lost in triviality. Try and draw them into big questions, big themes, what they really believe. So those are my tips about, I think, getting the best out of a politician.
And the tips for politicians to make it work for them. And that's also, you mentioned there, what do they want? What are their focus?
Well, they've got a lot to learn on this, I think. I think, first of all, listen again. They should be listening to what the question is and trying to think about how the audience hearing that question, what they're going to want to hear, what kind of response.
Often they pivot to their own answer, don't they? As a new Labour issue, you identify in the book.
Yeah, it's true. Although actually it's interesting. So Edward Heath talked about being on message back in the 60s. He was talking about this. So it's a lot. It's been there from the very start. Answer the question, please. Okay. It's the big one. Just try and answer the question. And if you're not going to answer the next one, if you're not going to answer the question, at least try and do so with a bit of kind of...
Perhaps say, I don't know. Is that allowed?
Well, that would be great. I mean, the bottom line
is it great though? Or you look stupid saying, I don't know.
Look, you may say I'm a dreamer, but we've got to get away from this, which is this kind of, you can't speak. You can't say, I don't know. Imagine if a politician came forward who could be authentic and who could say that and who could somehow get out of this bind we're in, where people talking to each other, but not listening or not hearing. That's what we need to have.
Well, on that note, Rob Burley, thank you for joining us this week on Chopper's Politics Podcast. And we'll put a link to your new book, Why Is This Lying Bastard Lying to Me, in the show notes for our episode. Thank you.
Thank you.
Rob Burley there. And do let me know what you think about the role of the political interviewer. All nice things about me, of course. Please email me, chopperspolitics@telegraph.co.uk, or tweet me. You can find me at Choppers Podcast. Well, that's all for this week's Choppers Politics listeners. Thank you to my guests, James Cracknell, Lucy Fraser MP, and of course, Rob Burley. Thank you to my producers, Louisa Wells and Giles Gear. But most importantly of all, thank you to you for listening. And of course, for more insights into the wonderful world of Westminster, please do sign up to my daily Choppers Politics newsletter. It arrives straight into your email inbox every weekday, and the link for that will be in the show notes this episode. And don't forget to read my weekly Peterborough Diary gossip column, out every Friday at 7pm online, and in Saturday's Daily Telegraph. And as always, if you can, please do buy a copy of our newspaper. I know you won't regret it. Until next time, though, cheerio!
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.